We've come to sunny California, and it really is sunny this morning as we overlook Hollywood at the home of a man who probably sold as much Jell-O as Jack Benny did in his time on radio, Ezra Stone, the voice of Henry Aldrich. Good morning.
Good morning, Chuck. I take quick exception to that commercial statement. I wish we could have been as successful and sold as much Jell-O as Jack, but we didn't have his vast audience, nor did we have the longevity that Jack had. But we did very well by Jell-O puddings.
You did. You did all right, I would say. Ezra Stone, where did you first enter show business?
Philadelphia, the age of 7.
And what were you doing?
Radio then? And legitimate theater, child's roles in plays, touring productions that would come through Philadelphia and wouldn't tour children because of the labor laws, and would pick up local kids as they picked up local stagehands. But mostly radio back in the late 20s, Children's Hour in Philadelphia. Stanley Broza ran that, and Mrs. Broza. And quite a few of folks that you know in show business and the entertainment business came out of that show. Kitty Callan, Eddie Fisher, Mickey Callan. And it kind of, I think, helped create that whole area of acceptance for performers, performing children who obviously grow up and some continue to be performers. And Philadelphia, especially the south side of Philadelphia, has made considerable contributions into the dozens, especially in the musical field.
Yes. Did you have a long trip to New York when you you appeared on the stage in New York, and shortly after that, or sometime after that at any rate?
Well, no, my trips to New York were on the commuter train, actually. I was having my teeth fixed in New York in those days, and I would go over and back on the $2 excursion just to have a few wires tightened around my teeth. Professionally, my work in New York started as part of the touring company of a children's theater company called the National Junior Theater, which Henry Fonda and Mildred Dunnick started also. And that company played up and down the East Coast from Washington up to Boston on Saturday mornings doing standard and not so standard children's theater. And so that's what brought me to New York first professionally, and Broadway, as a matter of fact. I played Jim Hawkins in Treasure Island at the Alvin Theater on West 52nd Street back in my early teens.
Was show business your idea, your mother's idea, your father's thought?
It was all a... It had its origin. My folks are not of the theater, but they always have been devotees of the theater and of music, opera, concerts. No, it actually came as a result of a bad debt. I'm an old actor, a friend of the family's in Philadelphia, was having hard times and had borrowed some money from my father, and my father didn't want him to feel obliged to pay it back, and he very cavalierly said one afternoon, I believe, I'll take it out and trade, teach my son how to speak. I had developed a lisp, which I still have. I have great difficulty and approach very carefully any word with more than one L in it. And Mr. Maurice Sloan was his name. Very colorful actor. And was director of the drama group at the Y that I used to attend. Gave me elocution lessons. In those days, they were called elocution lessons. It really turned out to be more of a situation where I was his one audience, and for hours he would read and recite the standard works for me, and occasionally get me up to do the same.
You may have had and still have trouble with words with more than one L, but they're, again, back to Jell-O. No problems there.
No, there's a well-placed hyphen.
Yes. And it could be just one L on that, actually.
No, it's two L's. It's J-E-L-L dash O.
Yeah. Remember the flavors? Well, we won't get into that. You were you in What a Life, Clifford Goldsmith's play? That's
very
started the Aldridge thing?
Very much so, yes. I created the role of Henry Aldridge. It was a down-to-the-wire 2 days before rehearsals started as to who would get the part, Eddie Bracken or me.
Ah.
And the rose fell on my side of the court, and actually it worked out beautifully for both of us. I never could have had Eddie Bracken's career. He certainly could have had mine and more, as he did, but I'm very happy that I got my share.
How long did What a Life play on Broadway?
Over 800 performances, about three seasons, and about half of that we ran cooperatively. Mr. Abbott gave the rights to the play, to the cast, and I was instrumental in organizing the cast into a cooperative, and we ran at that pace, doing lots of in-school promotion. The radio show was just catching on. It seemed to be a good bet to continue the run of the play, and yet it never could gross enough to make it profitable for Mr. Abbott. But as a cooperative, we could all declare our salaries at minimum, and which is what we did until we built a nest egg. And any week that the take did not exceed what would have been our normal contracted salaries with Mr. Abbott, we automatically went on minimum for the following week. And it worked quite well. And as a matter of fact, dear Betty Field, who passed on just a year ago, was my first leading lady.
Oh.
First and only. When Betty left the company of What a Life to come here to California to do Of Mice and Men, which I think she received an Oscar nomination, if not the award, her share of our nest egg at that time, as I recall very vividly, because I thought it was a stupendous sum of $700 that she took in cash when she left the cooperative venture of What a Life.
This was in the late 30s now, wasn't it?
It was 38.
Yeah. Was this an unusual thing, this cooperative thing?
I've never heard of it since. It may have happened before.
Why did Mr. Abbott decide to do that? Because he wasn't making any money with it?
Right. And it would have been unprofitable for him to try. He just couldn't. He would have had to shut the doors and close the company down. No, Mr. Abbott is, always has been, a tremendous enthusiast for youth in the theater, and always seemed to reach out and use and cast young people as opposed to established stars, some people cynically say because he didn't have to pay them as much. But having been on Mr. Abbott's staff, I kind of, over the years of, in hindsight, realized that it was much more than that. He had a fine appreciation of young talent and received an inward joy from helping. And here he saw a company of young people who were ready to pick up a production and promote it and bear the risk of it within their limited means, and it meant that too that certain members of his staff would be on salary too to the production, minimum salary, so to speak. It gave him at that time, that summer of 39, three productions running on Broadway during the World's Fair in New York, And it all came together quite well for him.
Was this a common knowledge that it was that kind of a production then, a cooperative thing? I mean, did everybody up and down Broadway know that, or did they care, or was it supposed to be a secret, or what was the scene on that?
No secret at all. It was the basis of our publicity thrust. It was the basis of our entreaty to Mr. Lee Schubert to give us reduced rent. It was the basis for getting bank loans and all kinds of things.
Did members of the cast actually try to negotiate those bank loans and, you know, a better rate at the theater and all of that sort of thing, or was it still being handled by Abbott?
No, I undertook for the company the responsibility of leadership in that direction. Mm-hmm. I was playing the lead. I was very interested at the time in the production phases of my craft. I was on Mr. Abbott's production staff, a junior member, albeit, mm-hmm. of his production staff. And I just was that cocky a kid. I wouldn't have the guts to do it now, but...
I think you might be wrong on that. How old were you at that time?
Well, I'm
a teenager.
I was a teenager. I'm a terrible mathematician. It's all in the books if you want to figure it out. I don't hide anything.
Well, I'm just wondering. As a teenager, you were taking on this responsibility. That must have been a fantastic training ground for you, and they give you great experience.
It was. It was indeed.
You said that at this time the radio started up. The first appearance of the Aldridge family, as they were called on radio, was with wasn't that with Rudy Valley?
Correct.
Now, how did that come about?
Mr. Valley at the time had a show policy, whether it was his or his producers, I'll never know. I tend to think it was Rudy's because he is that kind of a gentleman. And showman had a policy of doing, incidentally, Rudy lives just over the hill up here in Hollywood Hills. He had a policy on his old variety show of doing scenes or numbers from current hits on Broadway, mm-hmm. and giving both the production and the artists a tremendous personal and full presentation with great dignity, and you just weren't an anonymous individual on the Rudy Valley show, even though you might in fact be an anonymous individual. And so came our turn. What a Life got its turn on the Fleischman's Yeast Hour to do a scene from the play with all the wonderful build-up that Rudy, as a master of ceremonies and a devotee of the theater, even then, would provide for the production and the artists involved. And I'll tell you, it was quite a kick. I'll never forget to hear the billboard of that show when I went on and Graham McNamee's voice running down that list of stars for the Rudy Valley Hour that night and ending up with Ezra Stone. And that was, in fact, the first time my name went in lights, not literally, but figuratively. There seemed to be a superb reaction to that one scene. It was an 8-minute scene from the play. And the J. Walter Thompson people, they were the agency producing the show at the time, asked Clifford Goldsmith if he would write a special sketch for a subsequent Rudy Valley Hour, and he did. Very hesitantly, he felt that he had written all he knew about that boy in the 3-act play. We actually did 3 appearances on the Valley program through that summer period, and then the bidding started between Standard Brands, which was Fleischmann's Yeast, and General Foods, between J. Walter Thompson and Young and Rubicam, mm-hmm. and Kate Smith won General Foods and Young and Rubicam, and we were on her show as a regular 8-minute spot along with Abbott and Costello for 39 weeks.
Now, this was a half-hour show. Valley was an hour, wasn't it?
Valley was an hour. Kate Smith was an hour.
Oh, she was.
We were still an 8-minute spot for the first 42 times at bat on a variety show. And our first half hour came as a summer replacement for Jack Benny, also for Young and Rubicam, General Foods. And I remember Jack flew me out. I was vacationing with a high school buddy of mine and flew me out here to Hollywood on very short notice to guest on his last program of the winter season and give me a kind of pitch and welcome to his time slot for the summer replacement. And I remember sitting at the table down here at Sunset and Vine for the first rehearsal of the Jack Benny show, and what a high moment that was in my life, having been a fan and till his dying day and forever a devoted fan and I'm happy to say friend of Jack's, and watching him handle that show and construct with his genius of elegance and wit, turning it over to me. I remember it was one line, but be sure you give it back come fall. Came fall, of course, Mr. Benny got his time back, and we were very fortunate to start on our own time, and that went on for 15 years.
Boy, that was a long, long time, and a great run on radio. Were you, when you first moved into your own slot there after subbing for Jack on, I guess it must have been Sundays.
That's right.
It was always on Sunday. What night were you on then?
Most of our 15 years, we were on Thursday nights. There was a short period when, I don't know, as I say, I'm terrible on dates. We were on Tuesdays. We were primarily on NBC, although there were few years when we were on CBS. And as I recall, they were the years before I went into service and when I came back. But I'm not really sure.
The want to back up to the Broadway show What a Life, of course written by Clifford Goldsmith, and there were the characters were created, and you created the role of the teenager Henry Aldridge. Was that play pretty much like the radio show, or was it absolutely different?
Oh, it was very much the radio show sprung from the characters. You only in the play, you only met Henry, his mother. Much talk about his father, however, off stage. He was a very powerful offstage presence in the motivation of the play. You met one girlfriend, and that role was created by Betty Field. You did not meet the sister. Betty Field was the first Mary, the first actress to play my sister on radio. You met one sidekick, who in the play was called Dizzy, and in fact, Henry's first sidekick in the Aldridge family was Dizzy and was Eddie Bracken until Eddie came out to California. And then we thrashed around trying other actors, giving them different names as sidekicks until the heavens smiled on us and Jackie Kelk appeared, and then forever on was Homer. There were a raft of teachers whom you met in the play, but of course the plot of What a Life evolved entirely around a school incident in the life of Henry Aldridge.
The series then, when you started as a substitute for Jack Benny, had the basic elements, I would imagine, of the radio series as it developed along. Mother, Mr. and Mrs. Aldridge, and the sister, Betty Field, playing what was Henry's sister's name? I can't.
Mary.
Mary, that's right. And then you had Dizzy on the radio. Was Eddie Bracken at that point?
That's right. I believe it was. Mm-hmm.
When they made a couple of Henry Aldridge movies, they had, I believe, Jimmy Lydon in there. Wasn't it Jimmy
Lydon? A wonderful guy. Mm-hmm. He was a neighbor up the hill here, too, until just a year or so ago when he moved away. I never knew Jimmy in the days that he was carrying the ball as Henry Aldridge down at Paramount. But we got to be good friends and have worked together in various capacities since. I've directed him. He's had me up for things. He's a multi-talented young man, and he's just marvelous to work with. He's such a solid performer. He's a good executive. He's a lovely guy with a lovely family.
You have been, you were Henry Aldridge through the entire run of the Aldridge family on radio, with the exception of the time when you were in the service. And is that right?
Almost.
Okay.
Well, I was in service for a year before Pearl Harbor, and my day off was granted to me by Commanding General, Major General Phillipson, Commanding General, 2nd Corps Area, which was in New York, in the New York area, and I was stationed at Upton in the morale office there. And so Thursdays was my day off. I worked weekends. And I continued my radio show with my entire income going to Army Emergency Relief, which helped us with our... helped supply non-appropriated funds, is what it amounted mm-hmm. to, which we very much needed back in that era. Soldier shows and special services was unheard of. We were a morale branch, and all the activities were voluntary. And those of us in the entertainment industry and felt that morale, if it were necessary for fighting troops, and as necessary or almost as necessary as food and clothing, should have the recognition from the War Department in the form of table of organization ratings and budget. And until that time came about, and it wasn't far off, we didn't know that at the time, but within a year or so, special services companies were being formed. There was a training school at Fort Belvoir, and so the Aldridge family, in a very small way, helped contribute to that incentive and to the birth of This Is the Army, which I assembled and staged at Camp Upton, and then it toured the United States and then the world, all theaters of operation for over 4 years.
Did you have anything to do with the film, This Is the Army?
I was in the film, and I was so-called technical consultant on the film. We made that here at Warner's. And immediately after that film, I was transferred to the Air Force at March Field here in Riverside.
So much I want to ask you about the military, your military service. How did you find yourself in the service before the war broke out? I mean, I understand a lot of people would volunteer immediately after Pearl Harbor, but here is a successful actor on radio. What?
You never heard of that fishbowl and that magic number, 158?
You actually got drafted then.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
So you were a reluctant...
I wasn't reluctant, but I wasn't rushing the process.
How did This Is the Army develop? Was that when finally the government, the Office of War, or the War Department decided this is now, we must have this morale show, this kind of thing?
I think it was a convergence, a timeliness of the needs and intents of several people and several groups of people. By the time This Is the Army was underway in a firm planning process. I had then been transferred to Special Services Office for Second Corps Area on Governor's Island, and later moved to 90 Church Street in New York. And we had 30 post camps and stations in our command in the three states in the east, four part of Delaware. And we had systematically screened the wealth of talent coming through the reception centers in our core area, namely Fort Dix and Camp Upton, and had selectively placed people at each post camp and station so that we had the nucleus of a production unit at each place, musicians, producer, writer, director type of talents. And having this wealth of talent within our command, we could very easily, on orders from commanding general, put together a show, as we did for Mayor LaGuardia, who wanted a show from all the services in his area to thank the people of New York who had provided USO services for the military. And it was a thing the mayor wanted, and we put together a gala for him in less than 2 weeks at the Metropolitan Opera. Mr. Berlin, at the same time, was thinking, now is the time for there to be a revival of a soldier show like I did in World War I, namely Yip Yip Yap Hank, in which Oh How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning was introduced. Similarly, at the same time, Army Emergency Relief had just got its official status at the War Department as the relief agency for the Army, and it wanted a blast of some kind of patriotic military entertainment that would bring its organization and the Army Emergency Relief needs, which were considerable and mounting, to the general public for support. So all these factors came together. Mr. Berlin came to Upton to the colonel, commanding officer at the post, and asked if he could do a revival of Yip Yip Yap Hank for the Army. And then I was brought down to the general, and it went forward.
Did you stayed then with this military entertainment unit more or less for the duration?
For the duration and much beyond. I was in Fort Huachuca with Sarah, my wife. We do workshops. Mm-hmm. Last weekend, we're leaving tomorrow for Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Following weekend, we'll be in Fort Lewis in Seattle. And then on the 9th, we're back in Washington, D.C. for a worldwide conference of recreational officers, again, to beat the drum and spread the faith on the value of the entertainer in the military. The Army has a marvelous program. We've toured West Germany doing our workshops, Honolulu. We're down in the Canal Zone in June, Fort Lee, Fort Polk, and we're still very much a part of the Army.
You know, in just about a minute and a half, or you've spanned 30 years of from the end of World War II to today, and you're still involved in all of these things. What else have you been involved in, Ezra Stone, since returning to Henry Aldridge on radio, and then after the end of that long-run series on the air?
Well, I've been involved very pleasantly, Chuck, with ladies and gentlemen like yourself and very young people who somehow have become radio buffs and do us the very great honor and the great pleasure of being remembered. And that's taken a good bit of my time, too, from place to place. And I might also say that for those people who are genuinely interested in that era, NBC just came across 97 transcripts of our electrical transcriptions of our old radio show, and they will start to syndicate those along with other NBC shows to radio stations all over the United States.
Oh, that's marvelous. That's great.
I don't know. It may be putting a lot of you guys out of business, but...
Oh, no. Listen, we can't get enough of the good old radio shows. And they really were. And there's the only way that those could be received again today is if they were good in the first place. And they were. There was something about the radio shows that make them live on long after the last one was recorded or broadcast. And you had an important part in that, bringing a lot of laughter. And, you know, there was, as we listen to some of the old Aldridge family shows, they're not knocked down, slam, bang, gag after gag after gag, but they're honest situations, believable, and it's kind of a show that you may laugh out loud occasionally, but there's more of a smile to the whole thing, and I think that adds to its durability.
Well, would like to think that it is. It reflects another era that we will never see again, of course, and perhaps happily so. Although I think the old world courtliness and politeness of trying to, which should start in the home, where a child should have respect for his elders. That concept seems to have evaporated from our mores, and maybe in so losing that, we have lost a very important fabric of association with each other as adults. Remains to be seen.
You've been involved in some directing and producing as far as television is concerned, haven't you?
Yes, very much so.
Where does the Ezra Stone credit appear, or has it appeared on the tube?
On almost any morning rerun right now. Oh, it's a very long list. Working backwards, I guess, through hits and flops, it would be Diana Rigg Show, Sandy Duncan, Love American Style, The Munsters, Julia, Lost in Space, Laredo, Bob Hope, Chrysler Hour, Tammy, Karen, The Debbie Reynolds Show, Joan Davis Series, Joe and Mabel, please don't eat the daisies, Petticoat Junction, Pistols and Petticoats. It's a long line of a very similar fare.
Well, you've been really involved in show business your entire life, then, from a very young man to a man now who sits at the top of Hollywood looking out, and as we do here, over the whole city, and still involved in bringing good things to lots of people.
I haven't been in this house in over a month, and then it was just overnight on my way to San Francisco to repack my bags. And prior to that, I hadn't been in the house until I got back from Honolulu, and that was for 2 days. I'll be in the house 3 days this week and 3.5 next week, and then I'm off for a month again.
The man on the go. I appreciate very much this chance to chat with you, and I would be remiss in my duty to the listeners if I didn't ask if you could just give us that reply in the good old voice that you used to use when your mother called Henry Aldridge.
Coming, Chuck.
Thank you very much.